Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. When he signed the National Cancer Act in 1971, President Richard Nixon set in motion the war on cancer in the United States. 42 years and billions of dollars later, cancer is still our number two cause of death. Nearly 600,000 Americans will die from various forms of cancer this year alone. One of the most common misconceptions about cancer is that it's a single disease, when in fact it's a very heterogeneous mixture of conditions caused by both genetic and environmental factors. My guest today, Dr. Neil Capirasso, is at the epicenter of knowledge of prevention and treatment of cancer. He has devoted his career to the effects of tobacco in cancer causation and is working toward a future of personalized genomic medicine, the idea that your tissue can be typed to better understand which cocktail of medications will most likely control or cure the specific cancer. He serves as the chief of pharmacogenetics section in the genetic epidemiology branch of the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. He will be appearing in Tulsa Saturday, April 13th at the Mary Kay Chapman Health Plaza at St. John Medical Center, addressing cancer survivors and their families, friends, and caregivers as part of Celebrating the Art of Healing. I spoke with Dr. Capirasso from his office at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda. Dr. Neil Capirasso, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're excited for your appearance in Tulsa. I want to start by asking you to explain to a lay audience the term pharmacogenetics.
Well, as you know, there's a wide range of genetic research going on, and pharmacogenetics is a particular area of genetics, and it's an area that I've been interested in for a long time. And I'll just give you a little bit of background that my work focuses on the causes of cancer. And just a tiny bit of personal history, I became an oncologist back in the early 80s, and my aspiration was to cure cancer. And I realized pretty quickly that while we could help almost everyone with cancer, we really couldn't cure everybody, and we needed to understand the cause. And we really didn't understand the cause. Of course, we understand a little bit, but I understood that there are certain environmental causes that are known, like tobacco smoking for lung cancer, and there were a few genes that were known for rare cancers that occurred in families. But everyone believes that it's genes and environment working together. And pharmacogenetics is a model for how genes and the environment can work together. And we think that that's probably most relevant for actually understanding how most cancers work. So an example of what I mean by pharmacogenetics is that if you have a certain gene that you've inherited and you have a certain environmental exposure, something happens that's either good or bad. So classic example, G6PD deficiency is a genetic defect that's present in about 7 to 10% of the population. And if you happen to consume a chemical that is sensitive to that gene, for example, there's a certain kind of bean called fava beans. They're really good in salads and pastas. Anyway, if you eat fava beans and you happen to have this genetic defect, if you have the genetic defect and the environmental exposure, then you get hemolytic anemia. So you get the bad effect. But it requires both the gene and the environment.
So just to clarify, hemolytic anemia is where your red blood cells basically break open and cause you to get very sick.
Exactly.
And that's almost an archetypal example, but I think not that common perhaps, but you study smoking or tobacco abuse,
right?
Tobacco use and abuse. Give some highlights, if you could, of how we know that tobacco, you know, is incredibly strongly associated and we can say causes cancer, but cancer being not just lung cancer, which everybody thinks of, but highly associated with other cancers as well.
Well, that's a really great point. And today we take it for granted that tobacco is a cause for lung cancer, but back in the 50s and 60s, there was tremendous opposition to this idea, and even many scientists opposed it when the first studies came out, and they said things like, well, sure, there's a correlation between smoking and lung cancer, but that doesn't mean causation. Well, as the studies mounted, it became absolutely clear that tobacco was the cause, and people did studies where smokers were encouraged to quit, and you could demonstrate that the rate of lung cancer went way down, in addition, they demonstrated in different animals that when you expose them to tobacco smoke, the same changes appeared in the respiratory epithelium and the cells in the lung that appear in humans with lung cancer. So that was additional strong evidence. And there have been literally hundreds of studies that show that smokers are at greater risk of lung cancer. And as that evidence began to accumulate, it caused social changes that really had a beneficial effect. So one of the effects was that we began to have clean air legislation and workplace laws, and that in turn changed the social environment and made it not as acceptable to smoke. And so that has saved untold numbers of lives. In addition, you can remember back when you used to go into movies and there was smoking. And on airplanes, you know, there were non-smoking sections, but you could still smell the smoke. So the pilots got together and the stewardesses got together and studies were done. And it was shown that, for example, the spouses of smokers were at higher risk of lung cancer just from the environmental tobacco smoke. And that, in turn, led to more laws and more restrictions on smoking. And if you look at, you know, I wish I had a diagram that I could show you here on the radio, but if you can see that as the rates of smoking declined starting in the 60s and 70s after the famous Surgeon General's report, 10, 15, 20 years later, the lung cancer rates also began to decline. And that's so important because all of the cancers, not just lung cancer, but all of the cancers caused by tobacco smoke are really difficult ones to treat. And so we really want to prevent those cancers when we can.
What are the other less well-known examples of tobacco-induced or tobacco-associated cancers besides lung cancer?
Well, people don't think of larynx cancer, but the rate of laryngeal cancer is 10 to 20 times greater in smokers. Another common cancer is bladder cancer, 3 or 4 times more common in smokers. Pancreas cancer, a cancer that's very difficult to treat and has a high mortality, more common in smokers. There are some rare cancers that are more common, like acute myelocytic leukemia, gastric cancer, which overall is declining but is more common in smokers. I mentioned head and neck cancer. So those are the major ones. And we should also remember that a number of the other major causes of mortality in the United States, much more common in smokers. For example, just regular old cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes, much more common in smokers. And another leading cause of death that people don't think about is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So that's your emphysema and bronchitis, and again, largely due to smoking. So people can really avoid a lot of disease and causes of death by just quitting smoking.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest, Dr. Neil Capirasso, is chief of the pharmacogenetics section in the genetic epidemiology branch of the National Cancer Institute. And Dr. Capirasso, if you were given Surgeon General czar-like powers, not just a bully pulpit, but actual magical powers, and you could wave your wand and engage one massive preventive health measure, this is sort of a leading question, what would you do?
Well, I guess I'd ban cigarettes. That would probably be my number one. But more seriously, you know, I should mention that the Cancer Institute as a whole certainly has a generous budget, and something in the range of $5 billion goes to the Institute every year. And that money gets spread out across the country to thousands of investigators that compete for grants to either treat cancer, investigate the causes of cancer, fund cancer centers, do all sorts of research that is very, very exciting. So, you know, that budget has been hurt in recent years, and of course the sequestration has resulted in some cuts. And the way this happens is that, you know, that grants that compete for money to do cancer research are highly competitive in the United States. So recently, the pay line, which is the level at which a grant gets funded, is in the range of 15 or 14%. So that means that of every 20 new investigators that propose studies and submit grants, only 3 out of 20 are funded.
Oh, my goodness.
So I guess if, you know, you gave me the magic wand, I think, you know, funding more of those young investigators that have these exciting ideas would be a wonderful thing to do, because there has never been a time in my lifetime, or frankly anyone's lifetime, where technology has been advancing so fast. And we need to apply those technologies. One thing that people don't realize, you know, we often talk about discovering the genes that are related to different cancers. Well, once you discover the gene, you still have a way to go to design a drug or an intervention to make that an effective medication to use against cancer. And so that is really a challenging additional piece of research. And as we discover these genes, we need to apply these new and emerging technologies. And it's the young investigators that are going to do it. So I think to see cancer therapy really advance, you know, that's how I'd use my magic wand. You know, fund some of those up-and-coming stars who can do this kind of research. And, you know, because we're beginning to see the first few examples of new drugs that are targeted against genetic defects, and they're so exciting. There's so much promise that they'll be superior to the chemotherapy and radiation traditional modes of treatment of cancer that, you know, we know can be very beneficial, sometimes life-saving, sometimes curative, but many times toxic, and unfortunately, you know, clearly do not save everybody with cancer. So we need new targeted approaches that take into account what we understand about the molecular underpinnings of cancer.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I hear lots of what I would call, you know, medical futurists, or people who are out there writing books and in social media talking about this personalized medicine, meaning very specifically, I think, this notion of taking tissue from a tumor, from an individual, being able to type it, assay it, and really figure out what molecular targets specific drugs or agents will be able to either eradicate or readily control that type of cancer. Are there current examples of this? I mean, the one that I think of is, you know, so-called Gleevec for CML is the most specific, successful example I know for chronic myelogenous leukemia. Are there other examples we have now that are currently, you know, available?
There are a number of them that are kind of moving through the pipeline and will become examples. So CML, chronic myelogenous leukemia, as you mentioned, is a great example, because since the Philadelphia chromosome, the exact chromosomal abnormality was described, and then the genes that were disturbed by that rearrangement of chromosomes, you know, led to the designing of a specific treatment. But general way that we're going is that for decades, really almost 100 years, we've defined cancer by what it looks like through the microscope. And now, with our emerging molecular technologies, we're redefining cancer based on the genetics. So looking at the actual genes and seeing which genes are broken. So that is so exciting. It's kind of like looking at a building through a telescope and then all of a sudden being given the blueprint for the building. So we are starting to get the blueprint for the building. And you asked me specifically, well, what, you know, where are the benefits of this? An example is lung cancer. Lung cancer is being divided based on our genetic understanding into different types. For example, we now know that a small percentage of lung cancer, 2, 3, 4, 5%, has as a key genetic abnormality defects in epidermal-derived growth factor. And there are medications, the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, that specifically target this defect. And sure enough, people that have this genetic abnormality, when given this class of drugs, respond dramatically. And we're identifying additional new mutations, and there are medications that apply to them. Unfortunately, for lung cancer, this only applies to a small percentage of those that are affected, but as we continue this genetic work, there's every reason to think that we'll uncover more mutations, and there'll be drugs that will match those mutations or will create those drugs. So it's extremely exciting.
It is exciting, and you can hear it in your voice, and certainly I've heard it from other oncologists and other futurists. And I guess one of the things that seems alarming to me is you mentioned the sequester, and you mentioned the fact that the pay line has really not grown. So, that's very competitive that only 3 out of 20 of those 20 applications to, say, the National Cancer Institute, how many of those are competitive applications? I mean, are all 20? If you could fund all 20, would you? Or is it a number like 10 or 15 that you'd like to fund out of 20?
So I think everyone believes that the competitive process is very healthy, and it selects for the very best kinds of proposals. But 15% is too low. I really think a healthier percentage would be 20 or 25. And you'd still get wonderful proposals, exciting work, but it's kind of like instead of a dirt road going towards the cure, you'd build a highway. And we're going to get there eventually, but we're going to get there a lot faster if you fund some of this new research. I know, for example, in our group, we had a certain budget, and with the sequestration, we were told, lop off 8%. For some groups, thankfully not for our groups, it means people have to go on furlough. Other times you're able to, find things to cut, but it's often the youngest investigators or the investigators that are building their career and have to do big studies to gain the publications that can establish their credentials. They have the most difficult time. So we naturally try to protect them. We try and preserve the most exciting studies. But as you know, anytime you have to cut the budget, makes difficult choices. And my worry is that generally that a lot of scientists, these are often PhDs or physicians that have specialized in research and devoted themselves to learning laboratory techniques. And just when they've reached the point where they can do this very exciting work, they find that the grants are really difficult to get and hyper-competitive, and it just means that some of them, won't get the training, won't get the grants, and, may have to go somewhere else.
Well, it creates a downstream problem, really, of, you're talking about a generation, potentially, of researchers or physician researchers who, aren't going to participate in a time-honored way of advancing knowledge, and it really, you worry about everything. You certainly worry about developing cures for cancer, but you worry about American competitiveness, ingenuity, know-how, industrial spin-offs. I mean, it's a whole cascade.
Exactly. These really are the best and the brightest, and a lot of the physicians that go into cancer research, they are not worried about getting rich. They are not out there to they are devoting themselves to an area that's not the most remunerative. And, they're idealistic and they're smart. And, my hope is that we can return to supporting them.
If a young investigator, as you mentioned, has spent, years training, medical school, research, residency, fellowship, and then is essentially denied or even gets a young investigator award, but then isn't able to eventually attract the kind of funding for scientific investigation, I mean, what are the alternatives? I mean, I guess they can always sort of, fall back into a clinical career, but I mean, will they turn to industry? That is, will they go and work more in a pharmaceutical firm, or where will they go?
Many of these promising PhDs accept jobs in other areas. Today, research is so interdisciplinary and so quantitative that their skills are in demand by industry and in other fields. So, but you know, many times outside of science. So some of them can be quantitative analyses and analysts for financial companies or, you know, work in related areas. But the worry is that they'd be lost to healthcare. And, you know, certainly some of them can be very productive clinicians, but we urgently need clinician investigators to try out these new treatments, because the best theoretical treatment is not going to be useful until it goes through clinical trials and it's demonstrated to be effective and not toxic. So this is work that can't be done on paper or in theory. You know, you have to work with patients. You have to understand the research side. You have to understand the clinical side. So it's difficult work, and it requires great skills. And we work so hard, and the investigators work so hard to get these skills that, you know, it's a tragedy to see that they'll be lost to this pathway. And I know how idealistic they are and how much they care. You know, many of them, like me, saw that, you know, our best efforts to save cancer patients don't always succeed, and they want to devote their scientific skills and clinical skills to improving things. So I sure hope we can help them.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Neil Caparaso from the National Cancer Institute. He'll be appearing in Tulsa on April 13th at a cancer survivor symposium called Celebrating the Art of Healing at St. John Medical Center. Dr. Caparaso, when we talk about a cure for cancer, it seems like we oversimplify it in the media. I mean, we're really talking about multiple diseases, are we not?
That's exactly right. And I mentioned earlier that one of the exciting things is that our molecular understanding is helping us redefine what cancer is. So there's certain common features that all cancers have, but cancers that start in different organs are very, very different. So lung cancer, when I say lung cancer, I mean a cancer that starts in the lung, generally caused by tobacco, is very different from a breast cancer that starts in the breast, and for which many times the exact cause is not known. So the treatments are different, the prognosis is different, very different. As for a cure, you're also right there that there's not going to be one cure. What we envision, I think, is that cancer will become more a chronic treatable disease, kind of the way AIDS has evolved. At first, there was, you know, only very toxic and partially effective treatments that would hold off the disease for a year or two. Today, AIDS has a variety of different and effective treatments that together essentially hold the disease in check. And I think that it will be the same thing. As we understand the different molecular lesions, the different molecular defects that define each kind of cancer, we'll have therapies that attack each one, and using those together, they'll be much less toxic and much more effective, and it will hold the disease in check. It may or may not provide a complete cure, but it will turn into a more chronic kind of disease that we're much more capable of treating.
During your career, I mean, you've seen, as you pointed out, you know, smoking on airplanes and movie theaters go from, you know, socially acceptable to, you know, not only unacceptable, but, you know, really anathema. I mean, people are horrified if they see someone smoking where they shouldn't nowadays. And I'm curious where you were when the great tobacco settlement took place and how that impacted your career, really.
Well, I look at the tobacco settlement as having really helped the states. And, of course, you know, each state has used the tobacco settlement differently, but to implement public health kinds of measures that have further decreased smoking and allowed us to have more prevention. So, you know, I just mentioned that most people don't realize that when we talk about the gains, you know, the decline in cancer rates, most of those gains have not come from new medications that are more effective, although those are coming. Most of the gains have come from public health measures that have resulted in a decline in the number of adults that smoke. So in my lifetime, the number of adult smokers in the United States at one time approached 50%. Today, we're just around 20% or a little bit lower for the number of adults that smoke. And that has resulted in a decline in all the downstream cancers, lung, bladder, pancreas, et cetera. And that is what has caused the decline in cancer rates across the United States, not to mention the decline in heart attacks, strokes, peripheral vascular disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So the other thing I'd mention about the tobacco settlement is that there are still legal battles going on, and the tobacco companies, it's surprising to note, still have a foothold in cancer research today and are very actively working to promote smoking. So, for example, their lawyers have secured access to our research. So tobacco companies often get copies of our research right as we're publishing it, and they have the legal right to look at our computers. So my computer has a little tobacco litigation sticker on it, and when I'm done with it, the hard drive goes to the tobacco companies. So this is a legal agreement that was reached a number of years ago. And, you know, we shouldn't forget that these companies still promote smoking. And unfortunately, it's projected that internationally, the rates of smoking will increase. And the actual numbers of lung cancers worldwide are projected to increase by 2030. That's because smoking is still relatively common in China with its vast population. And unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of tobacco-related disease to deal with in the future.
That's absolutely astounding about your hard drive. It raises all kinds of paranoia hackles about freedom of information and control. Well, Dr. Neil Cavarasso, I really want to thank you for your time today. And your willingness to come and appear in Tulsa for an audience of cancer survivors and their family members and caregivers. And thanks so much for appearing on Studio Tulsa today.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me. And I'm absolutely looking forward to coming to Tulsa and meeting a lot of wonderful folks out there and having talk with people.
Dr. Neil Cavarasso is chief of the pharmacogenetics section at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. He'll be appearing in Tulsa Saturday, April 13th at the Mary Chapman Health Plaza at St. John Medical Center as part of Celebrating the Art of Healing. For more information, call 918-744-0123. Well, that's Studio Tulsa on Health for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Opinions expressed by guests on Studio Tulsa are their own and do not reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you missed a recent show, you can listen to our archive at publicradiotulsa.org, in addition to following us on Twitter or liking us on Facebook. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.